Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Greetings from the Hill Country of Central Texas. This is Revolution of Military Affairs, and I'm your host, Amos Fox.
On today's episode of Revolution of Military Affairs, we're going to talk about the Russo-Ukrainian War and do a bit of a strategic assessment after 2 years into the conflict. This episode coincides with the paper I recently had released through the Association of the United States Army entitled The Russo-Ukrainian War, A strategic assessment 2 years into the conflict. At this state, the conflict seems to be at a bit of a stalemate, and a lot of analysts don't like to use that term, but I think in reality that's where the conflict is. General Valery Zaluzhny, the former commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, stated as such in an Economist interview in November 2023, and there are a lot of analysts out there who emphatically state positions counter to those of Zaluzhny, and that the war is in fact not a stalemate. But I think if we dig into the facts a bit and take an objective look at this and not an emotional look, right? Because as I've stated throughout this this podcast series, in general, I would like to see Ukraine win this conflict and come out on top. However, I think an unemotional look at this, an objective look at this conflict, will show that coming out on top, depending on how one defines that, is probably not in the cards at this point for Ukraine, unfortunately. Put the bottom line up front, I believe that Russia is winning the conflict. I say that because Russia, in my assessment, has its minimal acceptable outcome. It possesses the Donbas, it possesses the land bridge to Crimea, and it possesses Crimea itself. This victory condition is dependent upon a couple of key factors. First and foremost, or Ukraine's inability to generate a force that's sufficient to do three basic things. First is defeat Russia's forces in each of the discrete areas that I outlined above, right? So the Donbas, the Crimea, and the peninsula leading to, or the land bridge leading to the Crimean Peninsula. Second is the ability to retake control of that territory. So those three territories each need to be retaken. And then third, they have to hold that territory against subsequent Russian counterattacks. Again, if you ascribe to the idea that those territories are Russia's minimally acceptable outcomes, right, those are the no-kidding things that they define victory as, then they will retake, they will attempt to retake those if Ukraine is actually able to retake those territories from Russia. And there's no amount of precision strike or long-range fires or drone attacks that can compensate for the lack of land forces that Ukraine's currently facing. It takes land forces to defeat a land force. And again, I know this runs counter to a lot of things that many analysts are out there saying today. You know, some folks think that you can just put you know, TACMs and HIMARS and GMLRS and Hellfire strikes and all these different types of long-range fires over an area, and somehow that will count as being able to control or defeat a force in that area. But at the end of the day, that is fundamentally incorrect, and it takes a land force to remove a land force to hold territory and to protect against counterattacks against other land forces seeking to control a piece of territory. And so that big picture, that right there, is why I think that my assessment is that Ukraine is currently unable to turn the balance against the strategic balance in this war against Russia. This is also part of the rift, I think, that developed between Vladimir Zelensky and Valery Zaluzhny, was this idea of insufficient forces for the task at hand, right? So this is a strategic imbalance between ends and means, really. The ends that Zelensky is looking for exceed the means that the army, the military in general, could put out in the field and accomplish. And so, Zaluzhny and some of the pieces that he was quoted in over the past several months has said essentially that, Russia has far more land forces than Ukraine can counter with their own land forces, and the situation for generating land forces for the Ukrainian military is such that they are unable to generate sufficient land force for the requirements at hand. And so I think that that really is at the heart of this problem that we're seeing play out today. And again, I think the big takeaway is that it takes a land force to defeat a land force. It takes a land force to counter against a land force's counterattack, and to hold territory, right? To retain territory, it takes land forces, legitimate land forces that can defend against significant attack and counterattack themselves. And that is at the heart of this assessment. And with that, I'll go ahead and we'll work through this. I'll start on the Russian side, and we'll work through this and just using the typical heuristic that a lot of people are familiar with as it relates to discussing strategy. I know it's a simplistic outlook, but we'll use the ends, ways, means, and risk paradigm to look at each side in the conflict. First, we'll talk through Russia, then we'll talk through Ukraine, and at the end, I'll give a basic rundown of how I think things are played out and what the future of this conflict will be, at least for the next several months. So for Russia, their strategic ends, I think, boil down to six key points, and here they are. So first, it's fracture the Ukrainian state politically, territorially, and culturally. Second, maintain sufficient territorial acquisitions to support a range of acceptable political outcomes for Moscow. Third, maintain strategic material overmatch. Fourth, exhaust Ukraine's ability to continue fighting, both materially and as regards to Ukraine's support from the international community. And we see that playing out right now in the U.S. as Congress is dithering on whether or not they're going to fund more and additional support for Ukraine. Fifth, normalize the conflict's abnormalities, right? So this loss of territory, for example, is one of those abnormalities, right? We want to make that look, the Russians want to make that look as though it's not an abnormality and it's just part of the status quo. So normalizing the conflict's abnormalities. And then six, finally, is undercut and erode Ukraine's ability to conduct offensive operations to reclaim their annexed territory, right? So that's just that strategy of attrition that you see played out. These human wave tactics, meat tactics, whatever you want to call them. We'll talk a bit more about that when we get into ways. But those 6 points, I think, are really at the heart of Russia's strategic goals in Ukraine. Looking at risk, Russia's already weathered a significant amount of the storm as it relates to the invasion of Ukraine. They've been able to augment and offset a lot of the problems, economic problems associated with the sanctions that have been levied against them. They've been able to tap into other actors in the international system to help them offset some of the negative impacts of those sanctions, especially as it relates to munitions and other tools and implements of war. And so I think that risk is largely been addressed by Russia to this point. The second thing I think that is a significant point of risk for Russia is the domestic unrest that could potentially lead to political instability. Part of this, I think, Russia is taking head on. You know, the assassination of Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of Wagner Group, in August of 2023 is perhaps the most high-profile example of this technique. Further, in the paper, I wrote about the disappearance of Alexei Navalny, but in the time since this paper was written and today, we found out that Navalny has been, one would have to assume, executed by the Russian regime, but whether or not that's true or not, we don't know, but nonetheless, dead. Then you have longtime Kremlin henchman Igor Gherkin, who's been extremely critical of Putin and the Kremlin's handling of the war in the past year or so. He was recently sentenced to 4 years in prison in January of 2024. And then Russia continues to suppress journalism and try and silence opposition and dissent. There's been some protests in the wake of Navalny's death. And you've seen typical Russian tactics there, arresting protesters and locking them away. So I think that those two things there are the biggest things that Russia's got to deal with. Part of, I think, the other thing as it relates to social and domestic unrest is something that I think Ben Hodges pointed out, and I thought that it was a really good point, and that is Russia's trying to keep a lot of the casualties away from Moscow and St. Petersburg. And so by pulling lower social strata, people from lower social strata, the lower end of the social hierarchy there in Russia, and pulling from areas that aren't near the major centers, right? Not near Moscow or St. Petersburg, but pulling from out far east and northern areas, right? Out in that Siberian area. They're offsetting a lot of the potential domestic uproar associated with these high casualties by putting them on people that society tends to not care about as much, right? And that's how I think Russia is offsetting risk. Moving on to means, Russia is relying on their resource base in terms of manpower and material to overcome, to enable their ends, and then also to enable the ways that achieve their ends, right? And so they use these manpower advantages and these material advantages to essentially drive a strategy of attrition against the Ukrainian armed forces. They offset some of the requirements, some of these material requirements in terms of manpower, again, through the recruitment of prisoners. That's highly noted. Also through the use of proxy forces, right? So the Wagner Group, obviously contractual proxy, but then you've got the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Armies, both of which are cultural proxies, who've been used since the beginning of this war in 2014. Wagner's coup in June of 2023, or whatever the term is you want to use to call what Wagner and Prigozhin did in the summer of 2023 as they marched on the Kremlin or marched on Moscow. Nonetheless, that's cooled Russia's reliance on the Wagner Group as a supporting proxy force. It's also important to note at this point, too, that Russia's fighting a defensive war. They're not really fighting an offensive war where they're trying to seek grand amounts of territory, right? I think what they're doing, like we've just seen recently in the past day or so, Avdiivka all but fall to the Russian forces. I think what they're doing at this point is nibbling out little pieces are on the periphery of the territories that they have so that when negotiations with Kyiv do come, they have ample territory that they can cede back to Ukraine as a bargaining chip, if you will, to show that they are willing to negotiate, but not do so at the cost of losing their minimal acceptable outcome. And so that's an important factor here to understand is this defensive war, right? And so with that, defensive battles don't require nearly as much manpower as offensive fighting, right? So if they're sitting there on the defense along the contact line and having intermittent skirmishes and battles with Ukrainian forces, or you know, being attacked with rockets or missiles or drones or whatever, that draw on manpower is not nearly as high. And so while battles like Avdiivka are going on here and there, throughout the conflict. Big picture, Russia's on the defense, and so they're actually able to regenerate a lot of combat power. The other thing with this that I think is important to note is that support through good domestic or good diplomatic relationships with China, North Korea, and Iran are also helping Russia offset a lot of challenges they would otherwise have with their base of power, right? And so their ability to field resources to help them continue to fight. And so while Ukraine is relying on, you know, the U.S. and a lot of Western nations to help them, Russia is doing something similar, albeit with a different group of strategic actors, and that's helping Moscow maintain that material overmatch that they need to continue to advance towards their ends. We've hit it on the ways indirectly throughout this conversation to this point, but I think it's important to list them plainly here so that they're clearly understood and able to be articulated and analyzed. And so I think that breaks down into five subordinate categories, and so I'll list those here, right? So my assessment is that Russia is using a strategy of exhaustion, and that's a big picture strategic goal of theirs, is to exhaust Ukrainians, right? And so they're doing that through this the application of generating attrition across the front and just wearing down Ukraine's material back so that they can no longer continue to resist Russia's holding of the territory. And so I think that's, you know, the big picture idea there. But within that, there's the five points here. And so the first is incrementally increasing territorial gains to support negotiations later down the line. And I've hit on this throughout the conversation so far. I think it's, right now it's bite off little chunks, if you can, on Russia's side. Slowly, advance the fence, push the contact line just a tad bit further to the west, in hopes of, if negotiations do come, you can be in a position, Russia can be in a position to give back territory, but then actually retain what it is they want. Number two is fortify those territorial gains to prevent Ukrainian efforts to retake the land, right? So as you incrementally move up, you invest that area with holding forces that can withstand and overcome any sort of Ukrainian attempt to retake that territory. And that gets back to that point on number one there, where you have those territorial gains that you, A, your minimal acceptable outcomes, but B, also those territories that you can negotiate with later down the line. Number three is the destruction of Ukrainians' offensive capability to prevent future attempts to retake annexed territory. This is a distinct and nuanced point that I think needs to be examined in a bit more detail. There's offensive capabilities or defensive capabilities, right? And a lot of those, there's overlap. But nonetheless, if you destroy, and on Russia's side, if they destroy Ukraine's ability to conduct offensive operations and do much more than just holding the territory that they have, right? Then they're going to enable the previous point, right? That territorial fortification of annexed Ukrainian land. And so all those first three points there, I think, are really intertwined with one another and incredibly important to appreciate how Russia is going about retaining the territory there in Ukraine. Point number four is to temporarily elongate the conflict to outlast U.S. and Western military support, right? So temporal elongation of the conflict just means make the conflict go longer. I think Russia views time on its side, and if they can cause the conflict to continue to drag out while continuing to destroy Ukrainian offensive capabilities, while incrementally extending their front along the contact line, then they're in a position that is way far more advantageous for themselves. And then lastly, point number five, temporally and spatially elongate the conflict to exceed Ukraine's manpower reserves, right? And again, this is tied to all the other points. But if you temporally, so you elongate the conflict in time, right? You make it go longer than what Ukraine can support in terms of external international support, right? then that works to your favor. But at the same time, if you spatially elongate the conflict, right, if you make the conflict exist on a much larger front, that diminishes your opponent, in this case Ukraine's, manpower reserves. And if they're already tapped in terms of manpower reserves as it is, and you have more points of contact along the line, right? So like you have these destructive and seemingly pointless battles for places like Avdiivka, but what it's doing is it's spatially elongating, it's temporally elongating the conflict, it's causing more death and destruction on both sides, certainly, yes, but again, because Russia has this manpower advantage, the death and destruction aspect of things favors Russia and doesn't favor Ukraine. And I think this is also an important thing. If you go back and if you read Alexander Svechnin's book Strategy, this is one of the key things that he talks about, right? So there's this idea that attrition, you know, is bad. But if you read Svechnin, he talks about attrition as being something you do essentially in this situation, this idea of temporal and spatial elongation. If there's no decisive operation, no decisive battle, no decisive element of a campaign within a given point of time, then these battles and fronts of attrition help contribute to you accelerating your opponent towards strategic exhaustion. And so again, I don't necessarily, I mean, you can call it good or bad strategy if you want, that's fine. But I think it's just strategy. I'm not a huge fan of emotive terms like good or bad. Is it accelerating Russia to their strategic ends? I think it is. And is it pushing Ukraine away from their own strategic ends? I think it is. And so, you know, there's that. I don't get behind emotive ideas such as good or bad strategy necessarily. To summarize here with on Russia's strategic assessment, it is my assessment that Russia is winning. So if winning in a war is defined by one state's attainment of their political military objectives at the cost of their adversary's political military objectives, then I think Russia appears to be possessing the upper hand through 2 years of conflict. Russia's strategy of exhaustion and territorial annexation appears to be working, albeit at a high cost to the Russian economy and the Russian people. Nonetheless, they've offset a lot of that through various means. Russia's had to diversify its bases of power to maintain the war stocks that it requires to execute its strategy of exhaustion. And it has exacted a heavy toll on the Russian people to conduct its bite-and-hold tactics that have enabled the territorial gains to support its strategy of exhaustion. Considering that Russia is largely on the defensive now, holding its position along the line of contact, the toll on the Russian people will likely decrease in the coming year. However, considering Russia's defensive position, it will likely maintain the upper hand on the battlefield throughout 2024.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
All right, so looking at Ukraine's side of things here now, we're going to start with Ukrainian ends. So essentially, Ukraine's ends are fairly simple. It's to restore their international borders circa 1991, right? So retaking all that land, the Donbass, the land bridge to Crimea, and then Crimea itself. Those are things that it considers to be its territory, which, you know, it rightfully is. And so those are the significant goals there that Ukraine's after. An important point, though, to note here. So this is this requires offensive operations, right? Offensive, you got to go take that land back. It requires defeating the land force that's holding that land, right? Because there's significant forces, Russian forces invested in that territory. So physically holding that ground. So you have to go in and either scare them away, which the odds of that are probably not great, or you have to destroy them, right? You have to kill your way through retaking all that land, or killing them up to a point, them being the Russian forces, to where they throw up their hands and say, okay, we're done, and then they, you know, they abscond out of there. So significant challenge to bring that about. And again, that requires high numbers of people, high numbers of land forces. And there's an interesting point. Putin recently indicated that Russia has 670,000 soldiers committed to the conflict, which is a more than a 200% increase from Russia's initial 190,000 strong invasion force, which I think also included the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republic, plus probably Wagner Group and some other contributors. And so that's fascinating, because that number of soldiers committed to the conflict is significant, 670,000. Now, the number of those soldiers that are physically in Ukraine conducting combat operations, holding the line, the fidelity doesn't exist to make a good guess either way on what that is. Nonetheless, let's do a little bit of a thought experiment here. So if we're using the traditional 3-to-1 attack to defense ratio, right, and you can get into whether or not that's a viable thing. And if you go back and look, I forget the journal, but one of the premier international relations journals of the within the international relations community has had a really interesting argument between Trevor DePew and John Mearsheimer in the early 80s about the validity of that concept. Mearsheimer coming down on the idea that it wasn't a valid tool, whereas DePew said that he had, and he showed his math, he had the math to support the idea. So, nonetheless, regardless of your feelings about that heuristic, which is all it is, right? It's a tool to help us, in the absence of certainty, continue thinking about and planning how to do, you know, offensive to defensive operations and vice versa. So if we use that, right, so if Russia has 670,000 troops, and let's just say they're all in Ukraine, don't know what they're doing specifically, but let's just say they're all in Ukraine, and we'll consider them all combat forces. If you do the math, the 3-to-1 math on that, that is more than 2 million troops for Ukraine to have to muster to generate that 3-to-1 ratio against Russian forces. And so 2 million troops, generating 2 million troops, is probably outside what Ukraine can actually accomplish. Now, when we consider that, does modern technology obviate the need for land forces like some people suggest? There's a lot of people out there, to include General Cavoli, who's the commander of U.S. European Command. He suggested that precision strike, precision munitions, it actually beats mass. Now, this hypothesis has not yet been proven, and in fact, the facts on the ground in Ukraine seem to actually disprove that. And so, I think the matter of the fact remains that long-range precision strike, drones of all types, and excellent targeting information have done what complementary arms and intelligence have always done. They have supported the advance or defensive posture of competing land forces, but they have not supplanted it. Moreover, technology must be viewed in the context of both the operations that it's supporting, but also the adversarial operations that it seeks to overcome. If it is correct that Russia's strategy is primarily concerned with retaining its territorial acquisitions at this point, and thus Russian military forces are focused on conducting defensive operations, and that Ukrainian land forces do not have the numbers to conduct the attack, defeat, occupy, defend sequence in conjunction with those other components of combined arms operations, then the precision strike, drones, and targeting information might be the window dressing of a futile strategic position. And I think, seen in this light, Kyiv's strategy is out of balance. That is, Kyiv's ends, right, what they want to achieve, exceed their means. They they do not possess the things they need, in this case manpower, combat forces on the ground, to go in and accomplish those strategic ends. And because of that, I think this war can continue to be considered one of attrition. And that attrition favors Russia's strategy at this point. On the risk side of the equation for Ukraine, I think that clearly the obvious risk here is the loss of U.S. support politically and financially, as well as on the military side. And right now, we're still working through that problem with the U.S. Congress having not yet approved additional funding for Ukraine. And they're pointing right now to the loss of Avdiivka as what happens when we don't. When the U.S. doesn't follow through and continue delivering military support. And so that, could be an indicator of future things to come if this spigot of support isn't turned back on. But then coupled with that is, I think, one of Kyiv's biggest strategic risks is exhausting or defusing its military force so much so that Russian land forces might attack and confiscate additional Ukrainian land throughout the increasingly vulnerable positions along its front. And so this goes back to that when I mentioned the idea behind Svechen's strategy of attrition, right? You create these seemingly pointless battles that just consume manpower and resources. And to the outsider looking in, they probably look like a waste. But strategically speaking, especially in this situation where manpower has become the key discriminator between success and stalemate, which might be the ultimate driver of success or victory, these seemingly pointless battles become increasingly important. And I think Russia understands that. And I think Ukraine understands that too. And so that's one of the risks I think that they have to work through on their end is not getting engaged in these pointless battles like Avdiivka. But then at the same time, that creates a catch-22 where if you don't send forces to defend these areas that you probably aren't necessarily as interested in, but at the same time, if you don't send something there to stop those attacks, then you still have to you create this situation where an actor like Russia is going to continue to incrementally move forward and continue to take more land. So very challenging situation and a very high risk situation for Ukraine on both those risks. Okay, so it's no surprise that when we talk about means here for Ukraine, that manpower is the number one consideration. And then firepower, right? Artillery shells, rockets, missiles, that kind of stuff is not necessarily secondary, but right up there with manpower. But let's go back to the manpower thing, because I think this is an interesting point. So if Ukraine wants to retake its land, right, all the way back to its 1991 border with, borders that it had carved out at after the fall of the Soviet Union, it's going to have to go in and take the Donbass. And let's look at the Donbass for a moment, and Crimea for that matter. You would have to assume, considering the fact that Russia took both most of the Donbass, which is, Luhansk and Donetsk Oblasts, they took most of those, in 2014. They took Crimea in 2014. So one would have to assume places like Donetsk City, Mariupol, and a lot of the other cities along. I know Mariupol's outside that, but, Donetsk City, Luhansk City. And then a lot of those key towns in Crimea, right, that would actually increase the attacker to defender ratio from 3-1, again, using accepted military heuristics here, that would increase that required strength from a 3-1 ratio to a 6-1 ratio to take some of these territories that have been long under the thumb of Russia and Russian military forces, right? And so I think that that's another factor that's not necessarily being considered here, right? If we were to go in and try and, if Ukraine was to go in and try and retake Donetsk City, That would be far different than trying to take a city that was recently taken along the contact line and hasn't been held for very long. And so there would be these spikes in the offense to defense ratio as Ukraine moved through the subsequent retaking, clearance, and holding of currently occupied and or annexed, whichever term you'd like to use, territory in Ukraine. So that, I think, is a significant consideration as we look at the means aspect of this, right? The human aspect, the land force aspect. And so a lot of that, you know, is people. A lot of it's also equipment, right? So you've got to have tanks, you've got to have infantry fighting vehicles, you've got to have artillery, you've got to have everything that allows you to fight in a combined arms fashion, because as customary understanding today, if you're not fighting combined arms, you're not fighting correctly. And so that gets back to the point that we raised earlier and a couple times along this conversation here, is that if Ukraine's running out of war fighting materiel, right? Artillery, rockets, missiles, anti-tank, anti-air tank, IFV, infantry fighting vehicle type equipment. If Ukraine's running out of that, which it appears as though they are, then they're going to have significant challenges accomplishing their ends, right? And so means here are critical, and it's also clearly tied to the ways. Since we're talking about means and ends, it's hard to separate out the ways. The other thing that I think that's important to note is that if and when U.S. support is turned back on, and again, I don't know when this is, you know, this may end up airing after that happens or before that happens, I don't know yet. But nonetheless, there's going to be a lag between when Congress says, okay, we've authorized this, and when stuff starts showing up again. And so that lag, that space between yes and action on the ground, is also a significant vulnerability. And I would assume that Russia's paying attention to that too, and might use that window, that lag window, to make some sort of other significant or insignificant land grab, just to continue to occupy Ukrainian forces and consume Ukrainian resources. All right, so I basically talked about ways as I talked through means and also through ends with Ukraine. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about my strategic assessment, just the general summary. So I think the most basic finding is that Ukraine has culminated and they are no longer capable of offensive operations at the scale nor the duration required to retake the Donbas, the land bridge to Crimea, and Crimea. Additionally, the Ukrainian armed forces will require significant augmentation of land power to remove Russian forces from Ukrainian territory. Precision strike and air power will help, right? But Ukrainian infantry and armored forces must still move into the terrain, clear the terrain of Russian land forces, hold the terrain, and then prevent any, against any Russian counterattack. And so in light of that, I think that onlookers should not expect any grand Ukrainian offensive through 2024. They might attempt a smaller scale type offensive, maybe to nibble away at Russian held territory. But anything larger than that exceeds Ukrainian means. Further, if U.S. support to Ukraine remains frozen for an extended period of time, Ukraine's ability to hold the contact line with Russia will further deteriorate. U.S. weapons and ammunition and military equipment are vital to Ukraine's ability to defend itself, and each day without that support adds more fragility to Ukraine's supply network, its artillery forces, and its land forces. All this contributes to the proliferation of weakness to the Ukrainian armed forces and Kyiv's inability to develop a useful military strategy. In short, I think that 2024 looks fairly bleak for Ukraine and its ability to meet its political military objectives. Nonetheless, if the U.S. And its support to Ukraine is unlocked relatively soon, Ukraine's ability to defend itself might see a slight dip in capability, but it'll likely rebound relatively quickly. Ukraine's manpower challenges, however, will still prevent it from any large-scale offensives during 2024. The influx of long-range precision strike, air power, and intelligence from the U.S. and other Western states will help mitigate some of the personnel challenges facing Ukrainian armed forces, but it certainly won't obviate that concern. In summary, I think then, therefore, the attritional grind of forces aligned on opposing trench networks is likely to characterize the conflict between Russia and Ukraine through 2024. Looking at the overall strategic balance, I think we'll do just a little bit of a who's got the advantage here, right? So when we look at the ends, I think Russia has the advantage. Russia has to win by not losing. Ukraine has to win by evicting Russian land forces from its territory. Russia seems far more aligned and in better position to accomplish its aims than does Ukraine. When we look at risk, Russia's basically weathered a lot of the storm associated with its operations, and so its risks, I think, at this point are relatively low, whereas Ukraine has a significant resource problem and resource dependency problem that is a significant strategic risk that's directly impacting operations today. And so, again, I think advantage there goes to Russia. When we go back to means, again, advantage, I think, here is with Russia. Ukraine's limited manpower and dependence on the international community make it extremely vulnerable to being able to accomplish its ends. And I think that Russia, on the other hand, it can continue throwing people at the problem for the foreseeable future. Lastly, you've got the ways, right? Russia, again, I think here has the advantage. Russia's greater resource base allows it to conduct a strategy of exhaustion against Ukraine, which has limited means and cannot actively pursue its ends in a way that it would like to do. To close, I think it's important here to note that a strategy out of line, right, ends that exceed ways and means is not a useful strategy. And right now, I think Ukraine's teetering on that, on the cusp of that, and that's created this stalemate that we see now. But I think the other important thing, and this is something I've said throughout the podcast several times, it takes a land force to defeat a land force. All the other stuff, all the bombs and missiles and precision strike and drones and overhead stuff, that can be overcome in many cases by digging a hole in the ground and staying underground and only coming out when you need to, right? And so that's what you're seeing happen here. This proliferation of all this high-tech stuff is pushed people, in this case people, generally being Russian, well, hell, both forces in this case, underground except when needed to come out and fight or try and take something. And so because of that, again, this goes back to the point, it takes a land force to defeat a land force. Now, what is a land force? Today, it's human beings and augmented with material weapons of war, right? Tanks, Bradleys, whatever flavor of infantry fighting vehicle you may see, all sorts of other stuff, right? Moving into the future, perhaps, maybe that turns into some sort of automated system, right? Some little like tracked vehicle with a machine gun on it that can go in and enter and clear things. That'll help overcome those 3-to-1 or 6-to-1 ratios of attacker to defender. But right now we aren't in that space, and so human capital is still, I think, a priority resource as we think about armed conflict and as we think about the Russo-Ukrainian war. And I think really the most important thing to close here with, because this war is a land war, it is fought for territory, it is fought amongst armies fighting for territory. It's important to go back to Clausewitz, and again, I'm going to read this Clausewitz quote because I think it's apropos for this entire conflict, right? And it goes back to my idea there that to defeat a land force, you need a land force. Clausewitz writes that, "So long as I have not overthrown my opponent, I am bound to fear that he may overthrow me. Thus, I am not in control. He dictates to me as much as I dictate to him," right? And so I think this is critical to understand about this conflict, right? High-tech gadgetry and cool stuff and, you know, trying to legitimize acquisition programs, that's great. But the reality of war in many cases is it doesn't necessarily align with that. And to defeat a land force, you need a land force. And you have to put in armies on the ground that can go identify, fight, destroy other armies, and then hold that territory, and then hold that territory against, you know, counterattack.
some of these areas. Again, I think I've asked a couple of guests to this point, you know, what are their thoughts on potential insurgencies if Ukraine were to retake some of these territories that have been part of Russia for a long time? You know, and it's up in the air. That's fine. I don't have a thought either way. I just think it's a question worth asking. Nonetheless, it takes armies, it takes land forces, it takes lots of people to overcome those problems. And so I think if we're not thinking about the requirement for lots of people, then we're probably thinking about armed conflict incorrectly. And again, moving into the future, there may be little killer robots running around zapping other killer robots, but that's not where we are today. And so I just think that that's the critical thing here that we have to understand. So long as I have not overthrown my opponent, I am bound to fear he may overthrow me. Thus, I am not in control. He dictates to me as much as I dictate to him. That passage right there, I think, typifies this conflict and shows us why it's in a relative form of stasis right now, stalemate along the line. And considering all the strategic variables here, I think that Russia, unfortunately, has the upper hand. Russia, unfortunately, will probably maintain the upper hand through 2024. And it looks fairly bleak in my assessment for Ukraine to accomplish its strategic ends. I just want to thank you for listening today. Thank you for putting up with my lisp. It's challenging sometimes to say certain things. So if you hear me stumbling, that's why. I try and go in and clean it up, but sometimes I just let it go because, you know, you got to understand the human aspect of things. And that's one of the human aspects of me and my podcast is my little lisp that comes out from time to time. So with that said, thank you very much. I hope that Ukraine can meet their strategic aims. But again, I don't think it certainly doesn't look likely within the next year.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.